I'm Libby Price. Welcome to A Country Breakfast on RN. This morning, the frenetic bidding war for milk processor Warrnambool Cheese and Butter. Just why is dairy so hot to trot? And wool sheds, the lifeblood of a sheep station. One of the oldest sheds was at Goolgumbler Station in the Riverina, but history has gone up in smoke.
I heard the wool shed was on fire, and as soon as I drove away from the trees, I just saw this massive glow, and my heart sank. You know, it was like a death, really, because it meant so much to the family, meant so much to the district, and there's generations of people that worked in that shed.
Rebuilding Goolgumbler later on A Country Breakfast. Travel the country with our rural reporters as always, but before that, what's been making news this week with Edwina Farley? And Edwina, if ever you want to get the emotions flowing, mention live animal exports.
Yes, it is one of those hot button topics, and it's one of those where I think everybody in the rural department breathes a huge sort of harumph each morning when we wake up to the headlines. But this week, Federal Agriculture Minister Barnaby Joyce told us that images of Australian sheep being killed on roadsides in Jordan are confronting, but he's rejected any call for additional regulation or oversight of the live export trade. ABC TV's Late Line aired footage obtained by animal rights group Animals Australia, which showed sheep being trussed, put in car boots and inhumanely slaughtered outside of approved facilities. Now, the Department of Agriculture has confirmed that at least some of the animals in the footage are Australian and says it is investigating. While none of their treatment in Jordan is allowed under the SCAS welfare system, Mr. Joyce says that system is sufficient.
The unfortunate reality is it's probably the way the vast majority of animals are slaughtered throughout the world, but it is not a form of slaughter that Australians are compliant with. When there's a breach of it, we investigate the breach, just like when someone breaks into a bank, we follow that process. But every time someone breaks into a bank, we don't get another auditor of the police.
Well, the live export industry is trying to sound tough on this one.
It is. The Livestock Exporters Council, which is the peak body representing producers, has previously called for tough penalties on companies found responsible for flagrant breaches of SCAS. Council Chief Executive Alison Penfold says the footage shown is confronting and distressing, and industry is frustrated that incidents like this keep happening.
We need to show our vision for the trade centred around animal welfare. We need to be able to demonstrate actions for people to see that continual improvement in supply chains. And the most critical thing we have to do is earn trust. And sadly, incidents like we've seen represented on TV screens last night certainly do nothing to help us build trust and earn trust with the community.
And there are also claims that vets are being pressured to play down just how crowded the sheep are on the ships.
That's right. A welfare group, Animals Angels, has taken the Department of Agriculture to the Federal Court in Sydney for failing to suspend the licence of Perth-based International Livestock Exporters back in 2008. The case centres on a vet's claims that his report was edited to show fewer goats died on a voyage to Singapore. Now, the lawyer for Animals Angels, Dr. Malcolm Caulfield, said outside the court that the department had also heard from other vets.
Vets who have vast experience on live export voyages confirmed Dr. Lloyd Reeve-Johnson's allegations of being pressured by exporters not to report adverse events, but also that overstocking is probably routine in this industry.
And the Commonwealth's barristers argued in court that the Department of Agriculture did investigate and found the deaths to be of no consequence. The judge has reserved his decision.
We're going to be looking a little bit later on A Country Breakfast about an alternative to culling wild horses or brumbies, but in the Kimberley, they're finding the best thing to do is to shoot them.
They are. Aerial culls have started on two Indigenous pastoral leases in the central Kimberley in WA. Estimates of feral horse numbers on Lake Gregory and Billiluna stations range from 6,000 to 9,000. Now, the RSPCA supports the aerial cull, and Peter Camp from the WA Pastoralists and Graziers Association says given the remote location, it's the only humane option.
Pretty sure they've gone down the path where they've looked at every other avenue as far as trying to freight those horses through to other markets. Realistically, a lot of it isn't cost effective, and also to the welfare of the animals, transportation. They probably do more damage to them themselves on trucks.
Now, it's getting too hot in the kitchen in this rather unholy cheese war, isn't it?
It sure is. And it's one of those that sort of strikes the patient capital line, doesn't it, this investment in food processing. But this week we've seen more manoeuvres. The Canadian dairy processor Saputo denies it's dumping its takeover bid for Warrnambool Cheese and Butter and instead targeting its rival bidder Bega Cheese. We also found out this week the ACCC gave approval for the Bega bid for WCB. Of course, it's going to be weeks before the Foreign Investment Review Board rules on the Saputo bid. But Chief Executive Lino Saputo was travelling around Victoria this week trying to win WCB shareholders. He flatly denies speculation his company has been buying Bega shares. Mr. Saputo isn't concerned the Japanese company Kirin, which owns Lion Foods, has just bought a 10% stake in Warrnambool.
There's a lot of things in this process here that we didn't see coming, to be honest with you, and we're adjusting on a day-to-day basis. I don't feel any threat at all from the Lion bid and or the Murray Goulburn bid or the Bega bid. I think our bid is very compelling. We're looking at 50% control, and I think that is still very possible.
I love the way he mispronounces Bega to Bega. And by the way, Edwina, you have to be corrected here. It is, in fact, Lino Saputo Jr.,
Apologies, forgot the junior.
Yeah. Now, this is one thing where both state and federal governments have decided they're going to say we want it to be Australian-owned when they can't actually do anything about it, but they can still get the brownie points for saying it.
Well, that's right. It's pretty interesting, though, isn't it, to sort of weigh in on what is otherwise, you know, a commercial endeavour, really. However, this week the Victorian government said it wants an Australian dairy company to win the bidding war and take over Warrnambool Cheese and Butter. Peter Walsh, who's the Agriculture Minister, believes the Competition and Consumer Commission and the Foreign Investment Review Board should consider that a fully Australian merger would be in the dairy industry's best interests.
It would actually be good to see them bulk up into being a powerhouse from a world point of view. 7% of the international dairy trade comes from Victoria out of a number of companies, instead of having that spread across a number of potentially multinationals owning part of it. Let's have a be proud about having a real major player here in Victoria.
And Federal Agriculture Minister Barnaby Joyce also told us he would prefer Warrnambool Cheese and Butter to remain in Australian hands.
Let's go now to the chicken industry, because they've been a rather hefty fine this week for a chicken meat company.
There certainly was. The ACCC handed down a very big fine for misleading consumers, chicken meat companies misleading consumers about how their products are grown and raised. Byeda and Barta, which supply Steggles chicken products, were found guilty in the federal court earlier this year of misleadingly using the term free to roam. ACCC Commissioner Sarah Court says a $400,000 fine imposed this week shows courts take misleading claims in advertising and on packaging very seriously.
We think this is a very serious issue, both for consumers but also for other players in the industry, for their competitors who are doing the right thing and who are making truthful claims, and consumers must be able to compare. So we think this does send a strong message out to the industry.
Who'd have thought sheep shears could be so popular?
It was amazing, wasn't it? And creating headlines at Sotheby's, no less. A set of mechanical shears that belonged to legendary shearer Jackie Howe sold for $38,000 this week. That's well above the reserve price at an auction in Melbourne. The total price, which included the buyer's premium, was about $46,000. They thought they'd get $20,000 for it, so it really is well above. Of course, Jackie Howe is famous for shearing, wait for it, 321 merino sheep in just 7 hours and 40 minutes with blade shears at Alice Down Station in Queensland. That was in 1892, and that record has never been broken.
Many, many years ago when I was in London, I can remember Jacob's Creek claret and being slightly embarrassed that the English thought it was wonderful. But I do agree with this. Their Riesling is nothing to be sniffed at.
And look, you know, I thought it was time, given that we often talk about top shelf wine, to talk about the $7 bottle, which this week took out the trophy for Best Riesling at the Melbourne Wine Awards. The chief winemaker, Bernard Hicken from Jacobs Creek, says the Riesling benefited from an ideal 2012 season in South Australia's Barossa Valley.
We had great late winter and spring rains leading up to the 2012 vintage. And during the summer, We had a warm growing season, but we missed any sort of heat waves, and that is great for making wine and certainly great for making very high quality Riesling.
And I suspect that $7 tag might have just gone up a couple of bucks.
I think so.
Edwina, thank you.
Thanks, Libby.
Edwina Farley with this week's Rural News. Rural Reporter is next.
Hi there, Geraldine Duke. Hoping you can join me again for breakfast from 7:30 tomorrow on Saturday Extra and a new series on the rise of impact investing, putting your money where it'll bring a return, yes, but also do some good at the same time. We'll look at the growing range of social enterprises in Australia, starting with a visit to a Melbourne coffee shop. It trains disadvantaged young people and also delivers for investors. And cricket in the South Pacific, Barry Cassidy and his son Adam join us after 7:30 here on RN.
This week we visit a special festival in outback Queensland that raises money to pay for music lessons for local children and meet a Welsh farming couple with a hankering for fresh pork sausages. We're trackside at the Santa Teresa Bush Races in Central Australia, and I can assure you, no manicured lawns or rose bushes there. And we head behind the counter at the Scone Bar with the CWA ladies at the Royal Hobart Show.
And everybody has their own particular talents. You'll meet Chris, who's making the scones. The scones are made on site. And to be an apprentice scone maker, you don't actually have to kill somebody, but you do have to wait in line.
A good bit of old-fashioned country hospitality later on in the program. But let's start in Richmond in outback Queensland, where they're tackling the issue of music education head on.
Anyone ever heard of the Beatles?
Yes.
Yeah, mostly?
I'm sitting in a small school library in Richmond in northwest Queensland, halfway between Townsville and Mount Isa. Around me, 50 children sit cross-legged on the floor. Even though this song was a hit decades before they were born, they sit quietly and listen, captivated. Hello, I'm Miriam Hall, and hearing a professional musician is a treat for these kids. This town, because of its remote location, doesn't often get performers. Young Clancy is in grade one.
I live on a property. It's really far out of town.
I do the guitar at home. Dad helps me sometimes and Mum. I like the rock and roll because it was loud and it was fast.
I am Adelaide and I'm 10. I liked that Spanish music thing because it was quick. It was a guitar.
Yeah. And did you like the sound of it?
Yes, because it was fast and sometimes it was slow. It was like changing a lot.
I think it was pretty awesome because I barely ever hear music like that because not many people come out here.
This school concert is part of the Richmond October Moon Festival, an annual event which brings jazz and blues performers from around the country to the town. The festival raises enough money to pay for music lessons and music scholarships for these children. It's also a chance for locals to come together and enjoy some live music gigs without having to go to the city. Casey Lord started this festival to make sure her community doesn't miss out.
We wanted to do something for the community, and we did a survey, and out of that survey came that there was no music at all taught in the community. So we decided to hold a music festival, and we didn't want it to just be any old music festival. We wanted it to be something, a music festival with a difference. So we decided to call it a jazz festival. And that was 6 years ago, and the purpose was to raise money for musical education in the community. We've now got 12 piano students, 3 violin students, and a music group that comes and goes, and a children's choir of, I think there's 9 in the children's choir. So, you know, for a small community, and we are a very small community, I think we've been really successful. And the other lovely thing is that music now happens at every social event, public social event that's going. Somebody grabs a guitar, or there's always got a band or something. Something's always happening.
And it's all because of that festival.
Yes. So, and I think music just relaxes everybody, and it sets a great tone. It crosses all barriers, It's wonderful for a social gathering.
It's not just about your region, is it? You want to try and, I guess, put Richmond on the map for another reason, apart from cattle.
Yeah, I do. And I also want to create something, we all want to create something different in the community. Something once a year we can put on something that just doesn't happen anywhere else in North Queensland.
It must be wonderful for you to see the children performing, knowing that they've had that opportunity to get lessons because of the festival itself.
Yeah, it's lovely. And the other thing we do is we have a scholarship fund, and that scholarship fund funds the musical education for the first year when the kids go to boarding school. Those kids are now coming back and performing at the October Moon Festival, and it is wonderful. It's really gratifying to see. Because often, because we subsidise the lessons, it can be a big drain for parents to then start putting out money for lessons when they go to boarding school on top of everything else. So I think it really helps keep that musical thing going in families.
Yeah, so it's not just at the end of primary school it all stops.
Absolutely.
Why do you think that it's important to have kids learning music? I mean, obviously not everyone's going to go on to have a musical career. Why, even so, did you want to try and invest in something like that?
I think, like a lot of things that parents do, it comes out of your own failed aspirations. I'd love to have been a piano player and never was. But I also believe that music is good for the soul, it's good for creativity, and I think it puts people into another zone. And I think it's important for us all to be able to get away from the business, away from cattle, and be in another zone just for a little while. And I believe music does that to people.
In Richmond, the heat soars to above 40 degrees, but around dusk it becomes a perfect temperature. The evening of the October Moon Festival is no exception, and Melbourne duo Wizard and Oz is on the stage. They've toured around Australia, but never to this part of the country. And after performing, they're spending some time at a local property.
My name's Dave McMillan. I am the Oz part of the Wizard and Oz.
And you too, Andrew, if you don't mind?
I'm the Wizard part of the Wizard and Oz, and I play piano and sing.
What's it like coming to a place like this and playing?
You know, we come away and we just don't realise what people are dealing with, I suppose, you know, the severity of this weather. We don't have any drought problems, and because we don't see it, everyone down there thinks everything's fine everywhere else, you know, where everything's okay, but obviously it's not here. And for us, you know, we come up and we see this and see the way people live. You know, we're lucky we can go to the shop anytime. And we don't have to go 120 kilometres to go and get some milk if we run out, you know.
What kind of impact or what kind of value is it for you as a musician, as a performer, to come out to a place like this?
Great. Yesterday, playing to the children, that was really nice. They were so attentive and joined in and asked questions, and they were interested to interact. Yeah. I love it. So tired of trying out
on the road again. At the heart of this festival is developing musical talent of the local kids. 14-year-old Narita is from Richmond and, thanks to the festival, got the chance to learn guitar. She's now at boarding school in Charters Towers, where she's still learning to play.
We don't have a lot of opportunities out here. If you think about it, we don't have a lot of music teachers out here, but the October Moon's helping that.
Why do you think you love guitar so much? What about it do you love?
I don't know, it's just that it can come everywhere with me. It is legit my baby.
What about when you're playing? What is it about playing that you like?
It's the thrill that you get when you're up on stage and then people crowd around you. If I'm in the dorms and I'm practicing, people come crowd around you and go, "Oh, you're so good." But really, I'm like, "Oh, I'm just practicing and I don't sound that good at the moment."
Do the other kids like listening in the boarding school?
Yeah, it's great. They all join in as well. We have a few songs that we all sing together.
Despite the scarcity of teachers, there's no doubt there's plenty of talent in regional Australia. Justin Borg is a mustering pilot and self-taught guitarist and singer who knows how much people love live music.
There's quite a demand for it out this way, and we're pretty blessed that is the case, you know.
People want to hear you play?
Well, I think so. Maybe they're just desperate out this way. I don't know.
But he does worry about the shortage of music teachers and the effect that might have on local kids.
You're sort of at a disadvantage a bit because you don't have the same opportunity people do on the coast. And I think that's the biggest thing that we've got to promote out here, because there is such a talent, like you've seen tonight. Like, these young kids have got such talent, but there's no one to bring it out, you know. There's no...
But you do.
Oh, we try. And I'm no musician. Like, I play and sing, and it's something I've taught myself to do. But when you're talking about real musicians that come from the cities and that are educated in music, I think that's what we need to push out here, is to educate kids in music rather than have them realise they want to play music when they're at the age of 25. It's a late stage.
In a way.
Yeah, it is. It's not too late, but you know, it's better if you can kick them off early and have them learn music.
Back before the stage, and Casey Lord says, fundraising aside, it's important for the people of this community to get together.
I think it's really important to come together as a community to do something special, to see your friends, have an afternoon out, swap stories about the drought if that's what floats your boat, or talk about something completely different just for one afternoon. I think psychologically it's really important that people do that.
We sort of make a pig day spa. They've got a nice big wallow, they've got some shelter, they've got something to chew on, they all sleep together, and yeah, they seem to enjoy themselves outside.
What more could a pig want than its very own muddy day spa? Hello, I'm Kat McGoran on a rare breeds pig farm at Tarraville in Victoria's Gippsland region. When Richard and Sylvia Jones moved to Australia from Wales, they were disappointed to find that they couldn't buy their favourite pork sausages. So they decided to make their own, using pork from their very own pigs. And that's where the rare Wessex Saddlebacks come in. Let's go and meet the Joneses and their pigs in mud.
Yeah, my name's Sylvia Jones. Yeah, we live down in Tarraville and we farm Wessex Saddleback pigs. They are a rare breed, so we're trying to increase their numbers. Yeah, they're just really easy to handle. They got good temperament. And
my name's Richard Jones. I suppose I'm a pig farmer. The mothers are really good at farrowing. They forage really, really well. And yeah, they sort of look after themselves. They really love being outdoors. And they seem to have a happy pig life here.
When you were considering which breed to get, Richard, I'm assuming you would have considered some of the white pigs that are more common. What made you go down the path with these guys and the Wessex Saddlebacks?
Well, we started with two large whites and two Wessex Saddlebacks, and instantly we noticed that with the lopped ears of the Saddlebacks and their temperament, it was just chalk and cheese between the Saddleback and the white pig. So we decided to go for the more docile, non-aggressive pig.
One of the things with the Saddlebacks that I understand that they're a bit slower growing than some other varieties. Is that what you've discovered?
Yeah, they are a little bit. But then good food's worth waiting for, so, you know.
They do take longer to grow, but the food input is also less. The Saddleback is such a really good forager that the open paddock is where's best for them. We've actually got our girls on a bit of a diet at the minute because we've actually overfed them a bit too much grain, because they've got all the paddock out there. And summertime, we watched our Saddlebacks actually surpass the white pig in growth through the summer, just because they're a much hardier type pig for the harsh climatic conditions of Australia.
What's it like farming pigs and handling these piglets, you know, every day? I mean, they're just gorgeous, like from an emotional...
You just get to know their personalities and everything as well, and yeah, don't give the piglets a name. Only the sows, only the ones you keep in, yeah, because you get too attached otherwise, so... Yeah.
And they also, when they get a cold as well, they suck like human beings, you know, they'll have a cold for 2 to 3 days and they'll just suck and they won't get up and they'll just lie there with their sad face with a runny nose, and in 2 or 3 days they bounce straight back then. But yeah, you get to know them.
Do you think it's a breed that will become more utilised in Australia?
Yeah, I think momentum is growing for the rare breeds. I think people are realising that the rare breeds are a much hardier type animal. They do grow slower, but they're a lot less maintenance. So you have to weigh up your looking after and your maintenance costs of performance animals compared to a slower performance animal, which has probably got the better flavour, and they tend to look after themselves. You know.
Richard and Sylvia Jones and their rare Wessex saddleback pigs. Still to come on Rural Reporter, they're in for a wild ride at the Santa Teresa Bush Races, and it's time for scones, jam and cream in Hobart.
Well, smack bang in front of me is the panorama of a snow-capped Mount Wellington. To my left, the cacophony of Sideshow Alley. To my right, Showbag Pavilion. Hello, I'm Sally Dacus. Welcome to the Royal Hobart Show 2013. I'm here because I want to visit a Royal Hobart institution. Yes, it's the Scone Bar. Now, the Country Women's Association, as a lobby group, says they're more than just scones and jam and cream. But are they really? Stay with me and we'll find out. I'm with Lindy Cleland, who's the Southern Group President of the Country Women's Association. So this is the Scone Bar. This is HQ.
It is very much the case. This is the place that people who've come to the show over the years look for the Scone Bar. While it's nice and quiet and all you can hear is the ladies working, during the day, this room will be full of parents, grandparents, three and four generations who've been coming to this particular place for their scones, jam and cream to sit down and have a cup of tea. This is one of the places that most people will visit when they visit the show today.
Now, Lindy, I do also know that the Country Women's Association has run a campaign to say your organisation is actually more than scones, isn't it?
That's right. And that's one of the reasons that we sort of try to say to people, look, you know, always we've looked at a practical application. So where the show is normally synonymous with expensive food that's bad for you, the CWA, here personifies the fact this is good country food at reasonable prices, comfortable chairs, and we find a lot of people come along and they talk to us, they'll come and look at our various brochures and our information, and rather than a hard sell of somebody standing at the door saying come and join CWA, we try to show by example what country women are all about.
Now you're going to take me in behind the Scone Bar.
That's right. You're going to go into the Holy of Holies. We have over 60 ladies from every branch in the south of the state come and help over the course of the 4 days, and it's very much a case of people who do nothing else all year will say, I'll come and do a shift at the Scone Bar. And everybody has their own particular talents. You'll meet Chris, who's making the scones. The scones are made on site. And to be an apprentice scone maker, you don't actually have to kill somebody, but you do have to wait in line.
This is kind of secret women's business then, perhaps, isn't it? And I can see the ladies over here shelling the eggs with their gingham aprons on.
Yes, very much. They've got their gingham aprons. The whole thing about the Country Women's Association that people fail to understand is that it developed to give women an opportunity not only to help other women but to help themselves and to learn things. We have various committees and you work your way up to the head of the committee, and the lady over here in that gingham apron with the eggs in her hand, who I'm about to introduce you to, is Anne Doble, who has been the major moving force behind this Scone Bar for a huge number of years.
Sorry, I'm wet. I won't shake hands.
Now, Lindy tells me you're very busy, but you're going to give me a little bit of a description of what's happening in the hub of the kitchen here. Now, we've got the ovens over here, the hallowed scone ovens.
The ovens are only used once a year for scone making.
Sally, if you have a look, many of your listeners, if you say that these are a Derby stove, and that's in Fahrenheit. We work with a double Derby oven with Fahrenheit. Even though the gauge tells you, the ladies can open the oven and say that's not hot enough without looking at the gauge. Oops. Scones
are going in the oven.
Oh,
lovely. Toasty and warm.
Give me about 10 minutes more, I'll let you know.
Mary Hanslow, tell us what's happening here.
Oh, well, we're just kneading the dough to make some scones. I've been boiling eggs up to go in the sandwiches and turning sausages, so I've been a jack of all trades this morning.
So what happens? You have to bake them as people come in, or you just keep doing a stream?
We just keep a steady all day, don't we, Anne?
We bake through to about 2 o'clock or so. We do an afternoon batch as well to go up to the craft hall. We keep them fed twice a day up there.
So do you have any idea how many scones you're going to bake here over 4 days?
We counted them some 4 or 5 years ago, and we did over 3,000 in 4 days.
And I'd have to count the loaves of bread to tell you the sandwiches. I mean, there'd be more, I reckon. Looking back, it's fun. While it's on, no.
There's no manicured green lawns and certainly no roses blooming along the barrier fence. The Santa Teresa Bush Races in Central Australia are about as far from Flemington and the Melbourne Cup Carnival as you can get. Hello, I'm Carmen Brown at a very hot and dusty racetrack about 80 kilometres east of Alice Springs, where the Santa Teresa community is celebrating 60 years of bush racing. This would have to be one of the wildest races in the Northern Territory, as Aboriginal stockmen from across the region saddle up to show off their riding skills on some very wild horses.
The night rider we got is Barry Kavanagh. Horse name is Dynamite.
Also Raymond Palmer has helped organise the weekend event and also doubles as the race caller.
We got good experienced jockeys riding on the horses. We got young jockeys from Hermansburg, Santa Teresa and surrounding communities to come in, and Wallace Rock Hall as well. We come in and compete each other.
Some of these horses, from what I've heard, are quite wild. Are they straight out of the paddock?
We muster them and break them in and get it used to people and cars and see them gallop. If they gallop, we'll put it towards the race.
So a little bit of training, but not a huge amount of training.
Yeah, just a little bit of training and just get it used to the track, our track, because our track's a little dusty and a little soft.
Now, there was a bit of an accident here yesterday. What happened there?
There was a little incident happened yesterday. Yeah, because that horse came too close to the winning post.
He ran into it?
Ran into it.
And how's the young rider who was on that horse?
Well, I think it's he's all right. Health worker reckons he's okay, yeah.
Just part of bush racing, isn't it, really? Sometimes you fall off.
Yeah, that's our life, you know. When you fall off, you fall off.
Hello, my name is Philip Ellis. I help with organising up the Santa Teresa horse race here out in the community.
We're just at the mounting yard. What are you doing here just at the moment?
Oh, I'm also a community police officer. My job is to make sure that they don't jump on the horse if they've been drinking. If they've been drinking overnight, I come and it's a policy from the race committee and the community. Nobody jump on a horse if they've been drinking overnight or if they still got alcohol in their blood. If they do, they won't be racing. And it's most important because it's for their safety, for themselves, and plus, that's what I keep on saying to everybody, is this, the race is every year, so make the best out of yourself to come to the races and enjoy while you, and if you're a stockman, come here. Make the best out of yourself because you're a horse rider and just ride the horses, you know.
And have they all passed muster so far?
Yeah, most of all of them passed today and yesterday. They are the champions, you know, and they are a legend because they ride the horses and if they fall off, they always jump on. They also must wear helmets. They must have helmets too. Yeah, helmet. You know, put it on. Just for your safety.
Yeah, because some of these horses are quite wild, aren't they?
Yeah, all these horses are wild because they just picked them up last week, maybe 2-3 days ago, and they're all riding it, you know, and that's really good.
And is it friendly competition or is it pretty serious?
No, I keep it friendly, you know, because just say to them, look, just go out there to enjoy. There's always going to be one winner. Just make sure that you go out there and be proud of what you do.
Community Police Officer Philip Ellis, trackside at the Santa Teresa races in Central Australia. And thanks to Carmen Brown for that story. You're listening to A Country Breakfast. I'm Libby Price. Next, the bidding war that's caught everyone by surprise as things heat up in the takeover tussle for milk processor Warrnambool Cheese and Butter.
For your chance to win a holiday for two to the Woodford Folk Festival, tell us what you think makes a music festival divine. Held on the Sunshine Coast hinterland, Woodford is Australia's largest gathering of artists and musicians, and RN's Rhythm Divine is partnering with the festival this year. So if you've had a divine music festival experience,
we'd like to hear all about it.
The RN Woodford Folk Festival Competition. Look for Get Involved on the RN homepage.
The $64 million question in the dairy industry at the moment is who will end up taking over processor Warrnambool Cheese and Butter. Federal Agriculture Minister Barnaby Joyce has joined the chorus from Victorian Agriculture Minister Peter Walsh, saying the company should remain Australian-owned. There are now four companies involved in the bidding war. First out of the blocks was Bega Cheese 6 weeks ago, and its offer has just been given the thumbs up by the ACCC. Competitor Murray Goulburn then outbid Bega, but it's bypassed the ACCC by going to the Competition Tribunal to try to get approval. And the highest bidder so far, Canadian company Saputo, has to wait for the Foreign Investment Review Board. But Saputo's bid took a turn for the worse this week when the Japanese company Kirin spent $52 million in a day buying a 10% stake in WCB. So, is Saputo now out of the game? Saputo CEO Lino Saputo Jr. says he's still determined to win the bidding war.
Well, we've been looking at the Australian market for the last 12 or 13 years. I had the privilege to visit Warrnambool in 2001. I visited the plant, I met the employees, and I think they're second to none. Australia is a very, very good platform, and Australia has a very, very strong culture in dairy production. And so as we evolve and as we grow as a company, we felt that Australia would be an incredible platform for us. We've been patient. This is 12 years in the making, and we're excited to be in the position that we're in today.
And did the bid from Bega set the whole ball rolling for you, where you felt you had to move now or forever hold your peace?
Well, we've announced our colors to the Warrnambool board and to management over the course of the last 10 years. We've never, ever thought that we would get into a hostile takeover of the company. That's just not our style. It's not part of our character. I think that Bega just opened up the floodgates for all participants to start to consider being players in this process.
I guess the important part of it now is the Kirin bid. Now, did you see that coming?
Well, look, there's a lot of things in this process here that we didn't see coming, to be honest with you, and we're adjusting on a day-to-day basis. I don't feel any threat at all from the Lion bid and or the Murray Goulburn bid or the Bega bid. I think that our bid is very compelling. I think we've got a great story to tell. I think we'd like to help continue build the dairy industry in Australia. And I think that once we meet with the dairy farmers and we meet with shareholders and employees and management, I think they understand what our intentions are.
So you're still happy to proceed even though the Kirin bid effectively means you can't get 100% control?
Absolutely. You know, we're looking at 50% control. And I think that is still very possible.
Is it difficult when your rivals collectively own, what, 45% of WCB shares?
Well, I don't see that would make it any more difficult or any more challenging. I think that perhaps we may have to work a little bit harder at convincing the balance of the 60% that we are the right company to take over Warrnambool.
You've even had the state government say it wants WCB to stay Australian-owned. Were you expecting that from government?
Well, look, that, you know, unfortunately, that's out of our control. Again, if we have the opportunity to meet government officials, we'll express to them what our intentions are. And I'm sure that once we have an opportunity to sit down and talk, they'll see that we're not a huge threat to the Australian dairy industry.
Were you expecting this, that there'd be quite a backlash to a foreign bid?
It's to be expected, I would say. You know, we're from Canada, and there are some great resources in Canada that sometimes come under threat. And there is always talk and discussion about foreign ownership. I think open markets are good for all industries, and I think they're good for all countries. at the end of the day, we need to recognize that we're not buying land and we're not buying cows that we would ultimately export to China or someplace else. We're the middleman between the dairy farmer and the end consumer. So really what we're buying is brick and mortar and stainless steel, and we're buying processing capabilities. And I don't think there's any threat to national security with that.
When you say WCB would be a good platform, do you mean for exports to Asia?
Not necessarily. I think that first and foremost, we have to look at the domestic market and see the consumers that Warrnambool is serving here locally, first and foremost. And then, of course, as an added value potential, I'd see that there would be opportunity to export product into the emerging markets. And that's not exclusively China. You know, everybody's talking about China and everybody's on the China bandwagon. We've been selling into the international markets for the last 25 or 30 years. I think there are more net importing dairy countries than there are net exporting dairy countries. You know, countries like Russia, countries like Taiwan and Japan and the Middle East and Brazil are all net importers of dairy products. So although there is some growth in consumption in China, and I think that that could be a good growing market, I don't think it's the end-all, be-all for exports.
I guess the important thing here is, are you envisaging, if you are successful in the takeover, that you would substantially change Warrnambool Cheese and Butter's focus from domestic to export?
No, I think that perhaps maybe one of the most compelling things about our offer is that Warrnambool in the hands of Saputo would probably keep the company as stable as it's always been, with the same focus and the same orientation. You know, this would be our main platform in Australia. Management team would stay on board, and their five pillars of strategy orientation would remain the same. So, I think if we were to be successful in this bid, it would be more of the same for Warrnambool.
Now, you have to go through the Foreign Investment Review Board. Has it given you an indication of how long this might take?
Well, again, not directly from government officials, but my advisors are telling me that normally it takes 30 to 45 days, and so we're still within that window.
Now, the ACCC has just told us it's going to make an announcement about the Bega Cheese bid this morning. The expectation is that that will be given clearance by the ACCC. Does nothing happen until each of the bidders has gone through the approval process?
Well, look, everybody's got to have their own strategy. I think, you know, we're very clear about what our intentions are. We're very clear on our strategy, irrespective of what happens with Bega and their regulatory issues. And same thing with Murray Goulburn. I mean, we're staying the course. We're still very, very optimistic about our successful attempt to have 50% of the shareholders side with us. And we're staying the course.
But can Bega trump you by getting their approval first?
Perhaps they can get their approval before us, but their offer still is less than our offer. So at the end of the day, I think it's up to the shareholders to decide what best value they can attain.
Speaking of Bega, it's being suggested that you might be interested in Bega if you can't get WCB. Have you been buying shares in Bega?
Look, at this stage, we've got our focus on WCB. I think it's a great platform. I think it's a wonderful company, and we'll take this one step at a time. But right now, our pure and undivided attention is with WCB.
But have you been buying shares in Bega?
We have not been buying shares in Bega.
Okay. So this has probably ended up being a bit tougher than you ever envisaged.
Well, you know what? We've been through 22 acquisitions over the course of the last 16 years. We've probably been involved in over 100 different files for acquisitions. Each one has its own complexities. I'm not surprised by anything that happens in any one of our files.
Why did you wait until now? If you've been looking at Warrnambool Cheese and Butter for more than a decade, why wait until now? Why didn't you move when the share price was lower?
Well, because we're not hostile people. You know, I'd like to have the support of the board. I'd like to have the support of management. We could have perhaps taken an approach where we would have accumulated shares in the past and then make a hostile attempt to take over Warrnambool. That's just not our style. That's not the way that we operate.
So you're still confident you're going to win over all the farmer shareholders?
I'm still very optimistic.
Lino Saputo Jr., CEO of Canadian dairy processor Saputo, which has offered $9.30 a share for Warrnambool cheese and butter, and WCB's share value has nearly trebled just this year. Wool sheds are the lifeblood of a sheep station, and you'll find some of the oldest sheds in the Riverina, where the merino industry was established in the 1800s. At Goolgumbler Station near Girildery, the Rollinson family lost their shed to a fire last year. Our reporter Larissa Smith has gone back to Goolgumbler to see the new shed. She spoke to Bruce Rollinson about why the old wool shed was so iconic.
The original wool shed, we expect, was built around the 1860s. That probably was settled then. So I'd imagine that they wouldn't have been able to run sheep here without a functional wool shed. We do have photos of the wool shed in 1908, and it looks pretty old then. So I'd expect the shed that burnt down last year was around 153 years old.
What was the wool shed made out of?
The wool shed was made of mainly Murray pine, Oregon posts, and it had a corrugated iron outside, which was originally timber that we know from the historic photos that we have.
How many stands?
It's 24 machine stands and 12 blade stands.
Take us back a year ago to when the shearing sheds were burnt down. It must have been devastating for the family.
Oh, it was, absolutely. I came down, I heard the wool shed was on fire, and as soon as I drove away from the trees, I just saw this massive glow, and my heart sank. You know, it was like a death, really, because it meant so much to the family, meant so much to the district. And there's generations of people that worked in that shed. But, you know, it wasn't going to last forever. It's just a shame that it went away like that.
How did the fire start?
The fire was deliberately lit and charges have been laid. Goolgumbler's a very long-standing merino stud and a very famous sheep station. And there's no question in our mind that we would not rebuild and keep the merino stud functioning here.
How long has it taken to rebuild?
From woe to go, I didn't think it was ever going to get finished. You know, it was a long process with builders' designs and finding out, you know, what we actually wanted. But it was it turned out pretty exciting at the finish. We're still building the day we started the shearing. So it had the pressure on, but that's what we needed to get finished. And it's come up a real treat. We're really happy with it, yeah.
Peter Gebhardt, Bruce Rollinson was one of my students at the Geelong College in 1984-85. Bruce lost his shearing shed, and I wrote this poem about 10 days ago for the opening, partly because I loved shearing sheds when I was a small boy. I was a rouseabout to my father's shearing shed at Euroa in Victoria, and it wasn't a big shed at all, and he was the classer. My mother cooked for the shearers, and I was a rouseabout, and I loved the smells and the whole movement of the sheep. And so I thought I'd write a poem for Bruce about the opening of his new shed. And so now with joy, the shed has risen from the ashes, pickled with age and sunning. The sheep and the shearer can now return to keep once more the yearly compact. Classes and rouseabouts, bales and hooks, dags and droppings, all united in a ritual feast. Shear time, blade time, with sweat, oil and swagger. Soon the smells, so potent to the scene, will give the place its flavours once again. Ah, the phoenix grand bird has arisen with new life. The pen is like the tar. It can halt the flow of blood and heal all our wounds, however made.
When you come back to a shearing shed of this magnitude, a brand new one, how does that make you feel?
Quite nostalgic in a funny way. Very, yes. I mean, it's a glorious construction, quite unlike the shearing shed that my father had at Euroa. But it's a nice thing to think that a shearing shed is still being built. And the smell of the Murray pine on the floors there is absolutely beautiful, I think. And, of course, when you get the smells then of the lanolin and everything else that comes,
brings back the memories.
Yes. Mm. Brings back good memories.
Poet and former principal of Geelong College, Peter Gebhardt, speaking to Larissa Smith. Well, from one Australian icon to another, and the Brumby is renowned for its sure-footedness and general toughness when the wild horse is tamed. In New South Wales, a program run by volunteers is successfully trapping and rehoming Brumbies. It's part of an ongoing pest management plan in the Guy Fawkes River National Park in northern New South Wales. Jan Carter runs the New England Brumby Sanctuary, which takes about 40 horses a year.
Seven horses came out on the first fleet in 1788. We had three stallions and four mares. These horses came from England and South Africa, and they were a mixture of thoroughbred Arabian and Barb, and that formed the basis of the Australian Brumby. And how they got their name is interesting. There was a grant of land given to a free settler by the name of James Brumby. He walked off his land, he went back to England, and his horses ran wild and became feral. And people would see them and say, oh, those horses, oh, they're Brumbies. And that's how they got their name.
I've got no fear, you can take me outside, down the bush. Like, I'll get on this horse. That'll do.
Phil Snell is my name, and I was born and raised at Black Mountain, which is about 10 k's from here. I was very fortunate that I grew up in the days where horses were worked on the place up here, my dad. These horses, like that red horse, that chestnut horse there, he was trapped, him and his band of mares, in October last year in the Guy Fawkes. He was caught and they aged him and he was about seven. And he had 9 or 12 mares, I'm not sure, and foals and colts and things, and all in his herd. Yeah, they got him out. That little white mare that's tied up to him, or filly, that's his daughter. He was gelded in February, and I caught him. Well, no doubt he came here and they do their processing, like he's branded and drenched and so forth. And then I started handling him in June, and then it got too cold and he's basically on the way to being broken in.
So he's 8 years old now, because he was boss man, wasn't he?
Oh, he was the boss man. It was his mares and his kids and he run the show. And so all of a sudden, it must be hard, the big transition from running around in, well, I don't know how many 100,000 hectares, being caught, and then now he's in a yard and he's we're putting gear on him and I can ride him and crack a whip on him and you've seen what he's done. So it's a big transition, isn't it?
There's a lot of history that goes with Brumbies and nostalgia, supposedly sure-footed and wise. Is that true?
Well, the experience I've had, I think so. Definitely. You know, like they grow up in the wild. And that's like when they come to here, it's like catching a wild rabbit and putting him in a cage. They're, all of a sudden, they're contained and they just want to get away from it. Like, look at the heritage of them. I suppose to survive in those pretty tough conditions, and they're down in that Guy Fawkes National Park. She's not the plains. Well, just watching these horses, they're pretty sure-footed and they're pretty lively.
John Burton from Armidale. They were fresh from the bush when I came out to give Megan a hand to drench them here, and to see the transformation of them here is quite remarkable. Wasn't going to put my hand in the crush. They hadn't been handled, hadn't had a rope on them or anything, but they needed dosing, and I made up a little loop out of a piece of lasso rope, catching rope, and poked that in underneath their nose. Their first reaction was to bite it. Then they struck at it. There's dints in the front of the crush you can notice that where their feet have hit it. Absolutely terrifying. They were bouncing from the front to the back of the crush, just crash, 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 crash. We managed to get their nose over and put a finger in the side of their mouth eventually, and then put the drench in, and I didn't think I'd ever see them get to this stage where you can actually put a saddle on and ride them. To see them today is quite remarkable.
John Burton from the New England Brumby Sanctuary chatting with Lisa Herbert. And that's it for another week of Country Breakfast. If you'd like to have a look at some of the photographs taken for our stories, read some more of the news, or simply listen back to the podcast of the program, you can do all of that by simply heading to our website, abc.net.au/rural. Great to have your company this morning, and thanks to our technical producer, Mark Veer. On RN, I'm Libby Price. Talk to you soon.